Well, you do these things individually, and yet everyone, as you said earlier, it becomes an art piece for you, so that those people, I'm talking about your fundraising events, talk about that process. How is it that do you sculpt your programs and your party atmosphere to a specific cause? Describe that process.
Well, it's not a decorating thing. It's trying to give each one of the things that I do an identity. And it's to, I can do it all. I mean, I can raise the money, I can collect the auction items, I can work on the flowers, I can do the lights, but I put myself through the paces of someone that is coming to an event that for a reason, and nonprofit organizations have to raise money. I'm very disturbed today about the path that it's taking, where it's become like a business, where people make money off of the nonprofit causes. Either they want to do the PR, they want to do the flowers. I like the spirit of volunteerism to be an integral part of what's going on. It's like putting on a production, a show. Things have to be in place. I did one the other night, and you like backup and support, but you have to know that if you relinquish certain things, that they're going to be done with the same passion and commitment and dedication that I have. You want others to have it, because I can do whatever someone is asked to do. I think it's part of what has made this city a place that people look to philanthropy. When I first started, people that could support things didn't want to. They didn't want to be bothered. But now it has become part of the fabric of the life of people that live here that are in special circumstances. They're blessed. And the ones that can't do one thing, they can do it in another through volunteerism.
How do you, let me start again with this question. Your phone rings constantly. I've been in FARB Central Command, and I know that it's like a war room. I mean, the phone is ringing and there's constant activity. People are asking you to do stuff. You're a human, you have 24 hours a day, and so tell me who gets yes and who gets sorry, I can't do that. And how do you make that decision?
It's a very, I don't know, it's not definitive. Sometimes someone may know the right button to push. I have to see that I can make a difference, because I've helped the major organizations, the Museum of Fine Arts, the Houston Grand Opera, MD Anderson Cancer Center, and on. but I want to help them with my gift of self. That's how I want to help them. I don't want to write a check. I sometimes do both, but I want to give them that, to teach them that, and to help mentor people so that they will continue this gift. I have a gift. It's Nina Cullinan. You see Cullinan Hall at the Museum of Fine Arts. And I was chairing the Soiree on the Suwannee in 1970, and she said to me, I was thinking, I really can't do this. And she said, you have a gift. You have to do it. And then I was inspired by Nina, by Alice Brown, the Brown Foundation, one of the founders and a person that had a great influence at the Museum of Fine Arts, by Dominique Demeneal. These women I admired because what they were doing with their lives and the impact it was having on this city. We would not be the city that we are today without all of this.
It's particularly in the world of arts, performing arts,
and in medicine too, like neurofibromatosis. We were talking the other day about Reggie's bus, and it's a disease that is not pretty. The heart, people want to support the heart diseases, but they don't really want to support a disease that's not pretty. And he contracted this disease when he was a child, and it was the cafe. He's an African American young man. He's probably in his 30s, maybe 40s. But it's horribly disfiguring, and people are very cruel. I remember once he went to a Whataburger and placed his order, and when he got to the window, they slammed the window because they didn't understand it, and it's likened to the Elephant Man's disease. And one of the local theaters put that performance on and dedicated it to Reggie, and as a benefit for neurofibromatosis. I remember when he got fired from a job, he was at the he left the Salvation Army. Then he went to work at the NF office, and they let him go, and I helped him get his job back at the Salvation Army. But it's, even someone that has that many problems they're challenged, not only by their issues, but by the world at large.
So it's not just in a general sense are you helping people, it's a one-to-one thing on occasion.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there was a young girl, I was in HEB, and her mother worked there, and she came up to me, and I had done a telethon for cerebral palsy, and she said, I want to thank you for what you said to my daughter, because she has gone on to college, and then I couldn't remember what I had said. It was the first time we ever used the skating rink, covered the skating rink at the Galleria. Then I met her, and I was so proud of her. And if you can impact one person in your life in a positive way, it makes a big difference to me, and I did.
Talked about art.
My passion.
Yes, you had your art teacher, and is gone from being a student of art to perhaps one of the great private art collections of contemporary art.
Thank you so much for saying that, Bob. For me, I don't ask someone what I should pick out. I don't pick it out. I don't select it because of what it's going to become in value. But I remember being seated behind a post in probably the 80s when I bought my Henri Rousseau. And he was a well-known French artist. Unfortunately, many of these artists don't get the proper recognition during their lifetime. But when I purchased my wounded deer, La Venedita, the Frida Kahlo, I carried her all over the world so that people could see her. I didn't trust the people that they had that would come and pick up your painting, because she is a treasured icon. And was someone once said to me, if some catastrophe happened, what would be the first thing you would take out of your home? Well, it would be the little deer. But now the current people that have this will never take it and share it with the world, because people would go up and study this painting, you know, embrace it, tell you if there was a cobweb on the frame. It was that kind of reverence. Morgan Freeman at the Women's Museum, I like to go when I would carry the painting to different venues. I'd like to go and stand beside them and just to hear what they'd have to say. And lo and behold, there he was. His wife was on the board of the Women's Museum in Washington.
Did they recognize the piece, or did you just kind of saddle up with this picture under your arm?
No, it was on the wall. I didn't saddle up. No. But I did inspect it. Like when it was delivered, to make sure that it was uncrated and something, because it is a treasure, and it's, you know, I sold it after my son passed away, because things happen to you, and I didn't need to do that, but I just felt like I could die the next day, and what would happen to La Venedita?
So you have the little deer as a treasured memory of having once possessed it. I guess no one really owns art. Art belongs to the world in a very general sense, way.
But I feel like I helped. She wasn't as well known when I bought it. And I felt like I really shared it with the world, and it's something they wanted to embrace, and it may have had been her life, the suffering that she had, what her art meant to her, the time that she lived, the influences in Mexico, all of those people.
What is your masterpiece?
Well, my son was my masterpiece. He was my masterpiece, and I lost him.
But in terms of the events that you've created, as an artist,
okay,
you perceive
as
it from
an
that
artist,
place.
Well, I was thinking the Challenger Learning Center, which was a legacy for those that perished during the Challenger tragedy, and knowing the widows of that event, they came to me and asked me if I would help them do this. And now there are probably 56 all over the United States and in England. The Queen is a big fan of space science education. So this, and it goes on. That's one of, I have to tell you a few. I loved the Renaissance evening that I did in the museum with the Spanish and French courts, and the first time they ever dined inside the private galleries. It had never happened. The first $1 million that was raised in our city and state for the Stalin Foundation for Cancer Research, when entertainers would donate their talent and charities didn't have to pay exorbitant fees to get people here. And now entertainers are doing that with their own foundations. It's become hip to be giving.
Well, that's a good thing, to be hip and giving.
Absolutely.
Hip and not,
yes, exactly.
You talked about these other events. Talk about the University of Houston and what happened there. How did that all form, and what is it that you've done that you're most proud of for the University of Houston?
Well, I've done several events there. It started with the tribute to excellence of the University of Houston Athletics Department. There was a man named Rudy Davalos, and I was at a concert, and it was like he saw something in his eye. He was determined to get me to chair something there, and we did an event that honored Carl Lewis and Akeem Olajuwon, and honored two philanthropists on the campus, Lucille Melcher and Mary Cullen. So that was the beginning. And it was kind of interesting because Carl Lewis wanted to have it at River Oaks Country Club. And back then, it wasn't easy if you were African American or ethnic to have something there. People may not like that, but that's true. And I had to get a member to sponsor it, and I had to do everything in accordance with certain wishes. Then I chaired two events and started an endowment for Philip Johnson at the Hines College of Architecture. There were two blueprint balls. But the piece de resistance, I had a friend that was my significant other, and he was the head of Compact Computer, and I wanted to honor him in the College of Natural Sciences and Mathematics, and I raised over $3.5 million, and their ongoing scholarships. And we did, we had it at the Weston Galleria because there were 1,200 people. And we had levitation. Dr. Paul Chu was there. It was an amazing evening. Steve Forbes came in to make the presentation. And many giants in the world of technology came to honor Eckhart Pfeiffer at this Festschrift. Am I saying that correctly?
I was there. It was a tremendous party, too, by the way.
Yes, wasn't it something to remember and cherish? You've been there for many things. And I loved my night at the Alhambra for the Houston Grand Opera. That was another $1 million. This was in Houston.
Honoring Robert Wilson, is that the one?
Yes, the great, one of my great idols. I admire him very much. He's a great genius of the arts. And from Texas.
Wow, you've done a lot of work, and even as we are doing this interview, and probably in the years and years to come, there are kids on the campus of the University of Houston who ordinarily would not have been there without what you've done.
Thank you for saying that. Well, there's some scholarships, and I actually was in a restaurant, and this young woman was greeting people, and she said, I received one of your scholarships. And so, you know, these are small things that, what is the kindness of strangers, to quote Truman Capote, it makes my day, it makes my heart sing. I have lots of moments like that.
I'll bet. What is it that you think people don't know about you?
Well, I don't tap in elevators like my friend Gloria Steinem. But I do some funny things. I talk to my dogs like they're adults. And, you know, we have our little rituals and things. I don't know. I like cheeseburgers, a devotee of Mexican food, occasional shots of tequila. I'm a movie fan. And I don't think I fit into a mold. I never did. Even when I was growing up, I wasn't, I was a campfire girl for a brief time, but that's as moldy as I get.
I think people who view your life from the outside as this whirlwind of social activity and high profile existence don't understand that there's a humanity there, just as there is in Reggie Bibb. Yeah. And we are all people at heart.
It's not like that at all. I mean, that's just part of it. It's like if you're an actor, you go out on the stage, you put on a mask, and you become someone else. But there are these magnificent moments when you do these things that you just have these wonderful surges of it all comes together, why you're there and how important it is for you to be there. I was really happy the other evening at the Blue Cure event, after going through all that I did for it to be there, but just to see that it's a movement. It's like what the Susan B. Komen Foundation was like, except this is a young man that was diagnosed with prostate cancer at 35.
Gabe Canales.
And Susan B. Komen was the sister of Nancy Brinker, who had died with breast cancer. So it's a parallel. It's a movement. And we're on our way. I mean, people are embracing it, but it's so hard. There isn't lots of money involved. You have people all competing for the philanthropic dollar. You just have to get your story out there. And when you see these changes happen, and a lot of times there are a lot of athletes involved in the anti-cancer preventative lifestyle, and they don't really know how to fundraise, but they're willing to stand up for it. But it was educational for everyone.
Selling the story, telling the stories, writing, getting your thoughts out there clearly. And you've, on two or three occasions, done that. 2 books and 1 for children?
Well, I'm trying to get Maxie's book out. But Lucas Comes to America is a story of my adventure with him. After I lost my beloved Bogey, who was a Shih Tzu that lived to be 18, he waited a year after my son died, and I didn't want to get another Shih Tzu, so I, just out of respect to Bogey and what he meant to me, so I saw these 2 dogs walking by in front of my house, and they looked like Toto from The Wizard of Oz, but they turned out to be very fancy terriers from England. They're Lucas Terriers. So I asked the man that was walking them, I said, what kind of dog is this? And then he told me, I called the person up, Linda Finger, and I said, how do I get a dog like this? She said, it's impossible, you can't. So that was, for me, that's a mantra, to go for it. So I, what did I do? I called Sir Roger Moore, who's a friend of mine that I knew through UNICEF, and his assistant, Garrett Owens.
007.
The only one, I think. And so he helped me find this lady in Manchester, England, who was on a farm, Meg something. And Lucas came here to America at 6 weeks of age. And a friend of mine who had invited me to a wedding in Paris, wasn't going, but I said, could you do me a big favor? So he picked Lucas up at the farm, took him away from his man, and they had to go back and forth from the airport 100 miles. This is true friendship. Anyway, Lucas arrived shaking, and he's the delight of my life. And then later he had a romance with Zoe, who belonged to Linda Finger, and they had Maximilian and Jacques. And she wanted Jacques, and I wanted Maximilian.
So you have this very deep love and friendship with these animals.
Well,
probably all animals.
Dogs, miniature donkeys, miniature horses. There's a commercial now. If I could get that little pony, and I don't know where I'd put him or what I'd do with him, that I see in this commercial, he just tears at my heart. I used to ride the ponies on Alameda Street, and not the big ones. And anyway, that's the street in Houston where there was a stable. It's not there anymore. But I've loved animals all my life. Not cats, but dogs, miniature piggies, miniature rabbits, things like that. But we're sticking to dogs now.
Enough to write a book about.
Well, one's coming out.
Another one?
Maximilian, Along Came Maxie. But the other books are on fundraising, and I've had good conversations with people that have read my book, and it's a how-to, and it's almost like a blueprint that can help you learn things, and then you have to learn by experience, and you're not always, it isn't always easy.
You're not political, are you?
I am.
And
no one can figure out if I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican, but I'm really for the person. Actually, I stand up for veterans.
I mean, you have supported visibly Kinky Friedman.
Kinky Friedman, when he ran for governor and when he ran for land commissioner, and I'm thrilled he's not running for anything else. But he's on tour now, and that's great. And I even produced a record and a play.
And a play.
And Along Came Kinky.
So you have taken political stances, some of which weren't popular. Right? Political in the sense.
Are you talking about Jeffrey Jerome, the pig that that was living near Sears downtown with this lady, and she would dress him up, and she had him ever since he was a piglet, and they would give a food to the hungry. I went in front of the commissioner's court with her, Victoria Huberta. Eventually, the pig had to leave the area because he grew up, and that, you know, that was a really sad thing. And he died of a broken heart. It sounds like a rocker, Jeffrey Jerome.
The case of the homeless pig.
That's right.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? We had billboards. We did all kinds of fun things.
So that was the far touch to this political. It wasn't political in the sense of Republican Democrat, but in the sense of the little person being crushed by it
wasn't fair. It was a neighbor that had a grievance with her, and he didn't bother anybody. He sat on the front porch and entertained people with costumes, and they donated canned goods, and she went and distributed those to the homeless and the poor.
So neither Republican nor Democrat, we vote for the person, we support the person.
That's right.
But you will stand up and say, I don't think this is right.
Well, theater, the River Oaks Theater that was going to come down, and I had a group of people that had T-shirts, and we made candles with popcorn boxes, and we had a police escort, and we stood in front of the River Oaks Theater, and it's there. I'd like it to be refurbished, but not torn down, because it's a neighborhood place on West Gray, and people like to go there no matter what. They have good popcorn, too.
Preserve that sense of community. And you alienated some of your own neighbors over a house and that was going to be taken down.
Oh, that's right. You're bringing up all these fond memories. Gail Benson and I, and she took a stand, and there was two young men that were going to tear down this wonderful Spanish colonial, the only one of its kind, on Pine Hill in Troon, and they did tear it down. But they never built their home. We all stood out there. It was raining. We even pushed whatever you pushed to get it away from the house before they tore it down. That was it. You know, I still am a preservationist and believe that everything doesn't have to come down. We don't have to reinvent the city. We're going to lose all of our integrity.
Well, you've added a lot to the integrity, and you've described this city as being the heart of philanthropy in America, which I personally believe it to be.
I believe it to be that. I can remember being chastised by my neighbors where I live, and I've lived in this neighborhood for a long time. And someone said, why do you want to do something like that? I took up the AIDS cause, and I'm in the late 19... The first fundraiser raised $5,000. I did raised 100, and it was during the Whitmire administration, and it was a challenge.
It was a bold thing to do back then.
It was. It wasn't popular
at all.
And I'm trying to think of the gentleman's name that originally accepted the task, John Henry Falk. He was a humorist and had been blacklisted during the McCarthy era, which kind of ruined his career. He called me one night and said he'd been to a meeting and that he and I had to take this cause up, and I loved him dearly, and I said I would. And then he got cancer, and then it was all in my lap. And we did a play at the Alley Theater with Alan Ayckbourn. And then there was something else going on in the alley. They had the two theaters. So I looked out the window and I said, we'll have it on the plaza. But Jones Plaza is no longer beautiful. It's been, it was such a pure space. And we had wonderful people like Ricky Como performing, and food stations and auction items. And I never even thought it could rain. It was an evening of hope.
We talked about a lot of aspects of your life.
Are you going to get personal?
Maybe.
Oh, I don't know.
I'm going to ask you.
I don't have to answer.
I want you to think on it for a second, because this particular interview is being preserved for archival purposes. People that aren't even alive as we are recording this will be looking at this. And what is it you want those people to know that's important in life that you would like to convey? What is your message to those who view this 50, 100 years from now as part of their interest in the University of Houston and the archives that you have created?
That we all need to be relevant. We need to matter. We need to have a purpose. Maybe some people don't, but everyone's purpose is different. For me, I think I want to know that I have led a purposeful life, that I've contributed, that I've made a difference, that I have real value. You know, I was thinking when I saw this cute little boy in this building that I was in, that he's going to be a grown-up person, and what's it going to be like in his world? And look at the violence that's going on. I'm hoping that the time that I'm gone and someone sees this interview, that it'll be a different world, a better world.
You've tried to make it that way, haven't you?
Yes, I have. I try in my small way to make things better. I like to focus on the positive outcomes.
Struggles are forgotten once the baby is born, as it were.
Right, exactly. Just enjoy the joy, the moment. Feel free. Find your Z, your zest.
Edith Piaf, the singer. I'm not sure if it's on her tombstone. It probably ought to be had a very famous song.
I'd like to know.
Je ne regrette rien. I regret nothing. Do you?
I don't think I do. I regret that my son's not here, that I might not have grandchildren. I would have liked to have seen him fulfill his life. I think that I need to sort of start thinking more about my life and what I want to do. That I need to have a period of reflection now. I'm going into my reflective, maybe cocoon stage. Maybe.
I doubt it.
I don't know.
Every event is always your last.
No, but I really mean it. It's going to be a different path.
Different path.
Different path. Who knows? Maybe I'll go paint by the sea.
Are you an adventurer? Are we going on adventures?
Well, only if I get my poor knee fixed. I would like that. Not to Africa. I just would like to go somewhere. I love where I've been. Walking the earth and to see things that feed your soul and that are inspirational, and meet people that have something to say that becomes part of your song. All of us have a song.
I'm sorry, I just don't see you still by the seaside.
It's nice to contemplate it, but I'm not sure that it'll happen. I mean, I'm looking forward to throwing out a ball for the Astros at an upcoming game. In fact, you were showing me a pitch. It remains to be seen. I can hear you shouting all the way across the sea.
Throw a strike.
Yeah, throw a strike. Right.
Well, I guess that's probably a pretty good philosophy for all of us. Throw strikes.
We only want to throw strikes. You know, aim for the sky. Let nothing deter you. I like the challenge. I do. Taking AIDS on in the time that I did. I'm trying to remember the year. It was like the late 80s, the late 70s, early 80s. And it was, no one wanted to touch it at all. That's when we did raise the money for the AIDS Dental Clinic at the Bering Community Service Church. And Bering Church. And it was, the world is going in cycles and changing. Things don't get solved. You know, just new problems come up.
Well, you did have a personal challenge that you shared publicly to the benefit of a lot of other women. With cancer.
Well, I was fortunate. And that's why I wanted to do that event for MD Anderson having breast cancer. Maybe 20 years ago, and you never know. It wasn't in my family, and then Lyle Lovett's father had prostate cancer, and Don Henley's mother-in-law, who he loved, had breast cancer, so the three of us came together. Do you know how I got him to perform? I went to Galveston. He was having a book signing, and I stood in line, and then I asked him, and I didn't really know him. And that's how it happened. It's fun to be brave and bold. And he said yes, and we raised over $1 million, and that was the first time that anyone had raised money for both breast and prostate cancer. And people like Michael Milken came. I mean, it was a very interesting audience. Were you there, Bob?
I don't.
Maybe the whole room, it was at the Hyatt, was done in blue, and it honored Marvin Zimmer. Are you sure? Marvin's million-dollar dream. And he was a reporter at Channel 13, where Bob was an anchor. And everyone wore blue glasses, and we sang Happy Birthday to him. But it was, and we had these angels to commemorate Joni.
Sure, I probably was.
Were. You have to remember these moments.
Well, we've talked about
lots of things.
What is it that I haven't asked you that you just need to say and let it out?
There's just so much to say. I mean, you know, people say, well, why do you take up a cause? And you've asked me that. And it's hard to say why I take up a cause. It touches my heart. It stirs emotions. It makes me passionate. I think I know that if I set my mind to it, I will succeed in making it happen to the best of my ability. I guess I can't say no. Like Adu Annie and Annie Get Your Gun.
People can't say no to you.
No, I don't know about that. I've had someone tell me they were going to give me $75,000 while I was driving in my car. The great Ted Bauer, when I was chairing something for the opera, and he created a school of business at the University of Houston. He was such a grand gentleman, and I've just had these unforgettable moments where people respond in such a, and then 100,000 when I was doing the project for the College of Natural Sciences and Mathematics. I said, what did you say? Because it was the first time I ever took the tables to that level. So you have to stand with what you believe. What do you think, Bob? Is it a wrap?
I think we've talked quite a bit, probably about 90 minutes worth. And
really?
We could talk for another 90, but I think the important elements of who you are and what you've done and
but
what
I've
people
loved
should
it.
Glean from what you've had to say is there. And I just wish there were a million people like Carolyn, but the fact that there are not a million people like Carolyn Farr makes you even a bigger star.
Thank you. I try to shine and try to do, and even though I say this is it, I have so many people throw that back at me, but something will come along that I can't resist, that I need to give my energy to, and I'm not sure what it'll be next.